here. Hello and welcome to the Scanon Podcast, your weekly look at the world of film, Irish International. I'm Darren Mooney, and joining me are...
Jay.
Grace.
So this week we're going to talk about what we normally do. We're going to talk about the week in film news, we're going to talk about the top 10 and the new releases, but we're going to start with what we normally do. So Jay, what have you watched this week?
A little bit. I've just, an early slow week, I've watched a little bit in the last couple of days, so I'll be brief, but I'll fly through what I have. I started off with Volcano, continuing my disaster movie.
And a nice sort of segue from Dante's Peak.
Yes, which it's... Volcano was so was, much was it better an uphill, than
it is. Yeah. I told you.
It is a significant upgrade.
The superior
really
Volcano movie.
It's Tommy Lee Jones being Tommy Lee Jones in that kind of way that he is. And the script, the cast's actually really good across the board, actually.
Anne Hesh is in
Anne
there
Hesh,
as well.
Yeah, she's great. And a young...
I can't think of her.
Gabby Hoffman, that's the one. Yes. Who's great. And yeah, she's really good. And I really like her. Script's kind of light on its feet. It's fun. There's a really clunky but welcoming plea for kind of racial equality.
Oh,
like, this is
this
post Rodney King.
Like,
this is,
kind
this
of
is
like,
you know, in that kind of 90s kind of thing.
I love the idea of Volcano as a metaphor for like the racial tensions within Los Angeles.
But it has this kind
the
of subplot.
Ash makes everyone the same color.
Yeah, that's the kind of end. But there is this kind of thing where police officers don't trust this
oh
black
my
guy
God,
kind of
it's
character.
Color blindness.
Yeah. It's clunky.
Too,
as,
I forgot all
yeah,
about that.
It's a clunky as hell kind of subplot. And as Grace pointed out, we're all the same color kind of. But it kind of works. The message is okay. Like, we're talking about burying messages and stuff. Like, it's kind of clunky enough all the way through it, but it kind of works nicely at the end. It kind of pivots to exactly what I want to say. It's like, yeah, fine, I'll accept it. But it's good. It's good, good fun.
And don't forget the little dog.
Yes. Yeah, how could we? How could
who escapes
we? Yes.
From the lava, but runs back
dogs
in for his toy.
Always escape from the lava, though. That's the rules. If you kill a dog with lava, forget about your movie.
Or in any way.
Or in well,
have you not seen Jurassic Park, no?
Yes.
That not, was that enough fossilized and sort of...
I can't remember.
Okay, anyway.
Yeah. I don't remember there being a dog in Jurassic Park.
No, Jurassic Park, the Futurama episode with the dog that was fossilized with like a rich, creamy core of doggy
okay.
goodness.
Okay.
Now,
Jesus.
It's really touching.
Dark.
It's really touching. It's a story about a boy and his... Anyway, sorry, we're getting off topic here.
Yes, I followed up with Cliffhanger, which yes, Darren, I am including as a disaster film. I know you don't include it. I can see you bristling almost here. We've had this discussion.
My eyebrows are raised defensively.
There's a few avalanches.
Yeah.
But it's
one
got
particularly
a
good
big
one.
Bad guy.
John Lithgow is a disaster movie all on his own.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, in the same way, like Brian Blessed doesn't make Flash Gordon a disaster
if
movie.
If Brian Blessed was in Cliffhanger, there would be more avalanches. That's all I'm saying.
I think you could probably make an argument that although there is a human villain in Cliffhanger, the environment is so treacherous that it presents an added obstacle.
I'm saying it is, but... I can hear arguments.
It's also great.
Let it be said that Darren has not made any arguments so far.
You've inferred. Cliffhanger is one of the best action films in the 90s. It is terrific.
Is it the 90s?
Yes.
It's 1993.
Three?
Three.
It's
even
earlier.
Wow, I always
associate
with 88.
I saw this in the cinema when it came out.
96 is Daylight, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, that's it.
I'd be happier classifying that as a disaster.
Daylight.
It is. Daylight's great. I saw Cliffhanger and Daylight in the cinema when it came out. Cliffhanger in the first massive Savoy screen.
Oh, that doesn't exist
reopening,
anymore.
And it was the first film, first afternoon when it opened, I went to see Cliffhanger. And it was a formatively wonderful thing. And it's still great. I love Rennie Harlan. My love for Die Hard 2 knows no bounds.
But don't worry, we'll talk about that when we get to Christmas.
Oh, no doubt. But he's great. And Cliffhanger is fantastic.
He also gave Deep Blue Sea.
Do you see?
I am not bashing
an auteur.
An auteur.
Okay.
And I like
order.
His little nod to his nationality here with the Finnish flag and the parachute.
Didn't he give us the, what was this, the Finnish, did he give us the president's plane went down when, was that him?
Yeah, I think that was him.
The wait, did he
Samuel
give us
Jackson
the one with Samuel Jackson big game? Was that Rennie Harlan?
Fun.
I'm Rennie Harlan?
I don't know if it was.
Reasonably confident it might have been.
Okay,
it certainly felt like one.
Yeah. It certainly feels like one of those lost, those kind of lost sort of 90s kind of
does.
Action movies in a way a Rennie Harlan
I
movie
quite
does.
I enjoyed it, I have to say.
Not sure. I really like that one as
it
well.
It might not be either, but it feels like a Rennie Harlan film.
I don't think so, but I'm just drawing up the information here. It was directed by Jelmari Helander.
Ah,
and I apologize to Mr. Helander for mangling the pronunciation.
That's just ruined.
To Helander
right
and back.
I appreciate the effort.
Thank you. We'll move on.
All president and accounted for.
I then trying to clear some of my Filmstruck watch list, which is at 100 films at the moment for sort of 2 weeks to do that.
And you've got 2 weeks.
No
I watched Scattered Clouds, which is my ongoing Mikio Naruse kind of filmmaker, which I had mentioned before. He's made 80 films between 1930 and 1967. 11 of them are on DVD. So post-film struck, these were all but impossible to watch.
Will disappear into the ether.
I watched his final film called Scattered Clothes, which is really beautiful, really strange. It's one of his few films in colour. Most of them are in black and white. And the colours are really, really interesting and kind of add so much to the story in ways that it's kind of hard to describe, but if you're watching it, you know, you'll know exactly what I mean. There's kind of weird Hitchcockian vibe. It's about a woman that her and her husband are in Tokyo, and he's got a job to go to Washington with the government, and they're about to leave a few days from kind of whenever, a week later from where they are, and he goes up north with his boss to do kind of a work, and he dies in a car crash, and there's issues around the car crash as to what happened, and the guy that crashed into him kind of turns up at the funeral to apologise to the wife and family. But this sets off a kind of thing where they keep meeting, and there's a kind of a relationship kind of thing. So there's a touch of Vertigo, a touch of thing. There's a little mystery, kind of sinister underlying kind of thing to it, but it kind of gives way to a kind of, if you know his films, and I've seen a few now at this stage, it's kind of familiar kind of drama, touch of melodrama, but really heightened emotions kind of stuff going on. And the end of it's really, really interesting. It does all sorts of strange things with the kind of ideas of a car crash or something ending of lives, or seeing something, potential dangers in something, and how that will change your perspective on what you're doing and what you're seeing. Really, really interesting. And it seems like a perfect final film. It's kind of summation, I think,
of a kind of a career teams and stuff.
Yeah, so far, I'm hoping to catch a couple more before it ends. Last night, I watched a short, two Varda shorts, actually. The Varda season never ends in my house. Until the monster goes away, then it'll probably end.
Always Varda season. It is.
But I did only watch shorts, so I'll be quick. One's called Diary of a Pregnant Woman. That's not what it's called in French. I don't know what's called in French. Grace, I'll leave that with you.
Diary of a Pregnant Woman?
Yeah.
Journal d'une femme
enceinte. I feel like this is the wrong way to approach translating a French film title.
Yeah, probably.
I think you normally work the other direction.
All right. I don't have the French one, so if I had the French one, then we wouldn't be having this conversation.
I'll look up what the French title
is. It's L'Opera something. I can't remember. Anyway, it's a really strange little story. It's 1958, so it's one of early Varda kind of short. It's kind of set in the area she lives in, and she's pregnant, so it's kind of a response to that. And it's very surreal, touch of body horror, birth and death, all that kind of stuff. It feels like a Buñuel, Salvador Dali kind of vibe to it, and possibly French in the way sort of... if this was made now, it would be like a pastiche, but it feels like it's probably invented some certain kind of cliches in it. Very strange. Paris in 1958 was a completely different place. It's like, it feels like a different planet. Very odd, very funny. I really enjoyed it. And it's kind of all over the gaff in terms of a kind of story. It doesn't really care. So it's kind of, it's fun. Your mileage may vary on it, but I quite enjoyed it. And short doesn't hurt. And the other one I watched was Uncle Yanko, which is a film she made in 1967, where she was living in America. She'd just moved to the US, to California, with Jacques Demy, her husband at the time. And she made a short about it. An uncle of hers who's... There's even doubts as whether he's even an uncle. He might be a friend of
a family father,
but he's become the uncle in that kind of way. And she goes to visit him in... he lives in Sausalito, which is... What's it? The aquatic suburbia, it's called. So it's like an upmarket version of the sets of Beast of the Southern Wild to some degree. Like, it's houses precariously on the water kind of thing. And very strange, he's an odd kind of Greek kind of background, or does he? And there's also the kind of meta stuff going on about the introduction. Now, we didn't introduce the first time, so we recreated, and they recreated like three times the introduction. You know, there's all this kind of stuff playing with the kind of documentary form and I really like that kind of stuff, and it's really funny. It's a kind of thing about, you know, you accept your family no matter how ridiculous they are and how kind of puffed up they are to some degree. It's like, you know, there's eye rolls galore, but there's still love there, you know, that kind of way. Yeah. It's really, really great, really funny. It's like, is this art, is it artifice, is it nonsense, is it documentary? It's kind of hard to tell, but it doesn't really matter because it's really good. And very last one I'll finish with is Lessons of Darkness, which is the Werner Herzog documentary.
Okay.
Which was filmed in 1992, the First Gulf War, where the oil fields were burning in Iraq.
Yeah.
And he basically took camera crew out, and what looks like a drone. But I mean, drones did exist in 1992, but I didn't know if they were used prominently in filmmaking at a stage. It could be in helicopter, but I suspect it's not. It's hard to really tell. But it's these shots kind of over kind of the oil fields and through them and alongside, and seeing some people work on them. And it's kind of mostly set to classical music. Some words are there. Herzog doing his voice over things.
It's sort of pretentious meditation.
Not a huge amount. Little bits only. Okay. It's like, what words are to describe what you're seeing?
Yes,
you know. And this is done in the name of democracy. That's the whole kind of thing, you know. And you're looking at kind of devastation. You kind of run along the road where you see trucks exploded and all that kind of stuff. Really, really good. A kind of terrible beauty of image and sound. I really like that. It's only an hour long. And it's on Mubi German, if Ronan's listening, so he could catch it.
For a listenership of one.
Yeah, well, you know.
For you, Ronan, specifically.
Yeah. Ronan, watch this film. You will like it.
All other listeners, please pay attention to Cliffhanger.
Also, get a VPN. But anyway, yeah.
Oh, definitely watch Cliffhanger. And also Volcano.
Yeah.
Now, I've been hearing rumors that it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. So I may ask Grace, what have you been watching this week?
Yes, I've been watching a lot of Christmas mush. Or maybe I should say slush.
Or
right.
Quality
snow?
Christmas.
Snow?
I get it.
Sorry.
Jesus, we're all coming.
There's no escape from them.
Oh, good lord.
I'll start with like the serious film that I watched this week, though. I finally watched American Honey on Saturday, which was very good. I really liked it. Didn't love it, however. Felt like there was something there kind of stopping me from connecting with it. And I think on reflection, I do feel it was a little bit too long. I understand her approach in that it's very kind of loose and sort of impulsive in a sense, and so it's kind of the long, slightly meandering style. It does suit it, but I just really felt the length. I don't know, maybe it was just the mood I was in, but I really like this. I really like the naturalistic style. I think Andrea Arnold has a wonderful, wonderful eye for detail.
Absolutely.
Some of her more like what come across as very throwaway shots are so instrumental in capturing the style and the character that she's going for, and I think she says so much, or she can say so much, but really seemingly insignificant details like a glimpse of like a muddied window or like an animal in the distance that look really kind of disjointed next to some of her more close-up intimate shots, and yet it just always seems to capture this really lovely lyrical sense in her filmmaking, and there's loads of them in this, needless to say. But I think on reflection, the thing that might have taken me out of this were actually the other characters, the ones that aren't the lead character, Star.
Okay.
Because I found Star very compelling, a very interesting character in her own right. But I just felt like whenever the other characters were around, I know why they're there from a story perspective to sort of propel what little narrative there is, but it almost felt like they were intruding on her own internal dialogue and her own observations. And I just felt like if this were a story of her perhaps on her own, kind of almost hitchhiking across a couple of different states and just kind of exploring and discovering herself and everything else, I probably would have connected to it a little bit more.
Okay.
But every time they were around, I just found them kind of annoying, which I felt really bad about because I felt like I was supposed to connect with this wider band of misfits who were also out of place in America as a society and everything else, but it didn't really work for me. But no, overall, I do think it was very good. And I really love that approach that she took of America as this big kind of blanket vista that you're supposed to fill, you know, your dreams and hopes and visions, however hopeless or insignificant they may seem. But it didn't quite captivate me as much as I would have liked, but it's still very good.
Excellent.
So that's my serious universal film for this week.
I like that. We're now putting that away, and out comes...
And now out comes the cheese and the crackers. So anyway, in the course of... Well, I have parlayed this into research and researching an article now, but that's just me looking for an excuse to watch a ton of Christmas movies. I have a very deep affection for a lot of Christmas slush. I'm going to continue calling them that. So I've watched, I think, 4 this week because Netflix is very generous and has a bunch of them on there. And I'm going to try and find...
And as you discussed last week, they have a shared cinematic Christmas universe in which characters from one Netflix Christmas film have been known to sit down and
watch
literally Netflix and chill, maybe not in the sense the kids mean it, to other Netflix Christmas
it's
movies.
Very strange that, but I kind of like it.
I thought it was a very cute little marketing gimmick.
Synergy.
I really enjoyed that.
I know. It's kind of terrifying in a way, but I like it.
So
trust me, if the algorithm knows what you want, Jay, it knows what the characters in these films want.
It knows what the people want. I began by watching A Christmas Prince on Sunday, which is like a less good but still very enjoyable version of The Princess Diaries, almost for a new generation. So the story is pretty basic. The lead character is a journalist, and she's sent an assignment to a made-up European country where, of course, everyone is inexplicably English to cover the impending king's or the next king's coronation and sort of accidentally finds herself posing as a tutor for his younger sister, and so gets access to the house and the characters behind the scenes and so on and so forth. And from there on, it all proceeds in very fairy tale like fashion. But there's something very earnest about it. It's very cute and really leans into the complete kind of schmaltz and ridiculousness that it's going for. But all of the characters I felt came across kind of genuine, despite the obvious fairy tale imagery. It was very sweet, and I am very much looking forward to the sequel, which will be out at the end of this month.
Ooh.
Hang on, how long is it? Did
this
it
came out
two
last
months?
Year.
Oh, right, okay.
And
it's like the cast and crew get working on the next one. It's like the wrap party is a single bottle of Monet champagne that you have to share and then it's back to work.
Yeah.
What's this one called again? Sorry.
A Christmas Prince. And the next one is called A Christmas Prince, The Royal Wedding. And they have a fantastic ad for it on YouTube where it's like, there's a new another royal wedding this year and you were actually invited to this one. Hey.
Ah, okay.
Then after that, what came next? They're all sort of blending into one in my head. Oh, yes. A Wish for Christmas. This was subpar, but kind of trashy and enjoyable nevertheless. So in this one, the lead character works for a marketing agency and never stands up for herself and is basically a bit of a doormat. So she makes a wish that she can find her voice or something for Christmas, and of course is inexplicably granted, which leads to lots of scenes of her just basically standing her ground and saying, this is ridiculous and we should do this, and people actually listening to her. And then she ends up going on an extended road trip with her boss and helping him to mend his ties with his family. And it's all very silly. And the boss in this is like evil. I think he's presented as this, you know, he's supposed to be an endearing love interest, but he has everyone in his office working on Christmas Day. And then at the end, none of you are going to care if I spoil this part, but at the end when he's like had his bit of redemption and he comes into the office where everyone's working on Christmas Day and brings them some like cookies and presents, like this is meant to be a heroic moment for the staff he's got working on Christmas
Day. You don't get to see your
Day.
Family. I am your
this,
family.
This is capitalism though. America doesn't get holidays. They get like one day and they're gone back to work.
It's ridiculous.
It's such a strange country for that. Like they're not very good at vacation time. Like,
no,
at all.
They really aren't. And I just
I like that you call it
horrendous.
Vacation time. Enjoy about America.
I know, because I let them have their stupid ways of describing the language.
Okay, great.
Sorry, American listeners.
Then after that came Christmas Inheritance, also possibly in the subpar side, but I kind of like the shtick or whatever you want to call it. In this, it's a bit like Gilmore Girls Meets Secret Millionaire, because she is she's the heiress to her father's company. It's a toy company. But before she's allowed to take over after his retirement, she has to deliver the Christmas letters to his co-founder, who lives in a tiny town somewhere in, was it Vermont, I think? Somewhere in New England, anyway, where it's always snowing, because that's just how it works.
And plus it's Christmas.
Yes, but she has to go incognito, and she's only allowed to bring $100 with her, because that's all that they had when they were starting out. It's all very important. So basically, she has to prove that she's worthy of the company if she can go and
this
find
seems like
him.
A very poor way of picking a CEO.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, so your first meeting, your first year was disastrous in terms of stock management, but you did get that letter there.
You did get the letters there. But it's kind of interesting then, because she arrives and she stays in this little inn in this, you know, tiny town where the guy who runs the inn is also like the local taxi driver and everything. It's all quite strange. Then there's a massive snowstorm and they all get, this is a bit too soon after Snowmageddon for my taste, but they all get snowed in at the inn by the fire. She doesn't know how to separate eggs when she's helping his aunt try to cook. This is ridiculous. I don't know how anyone.
Hang on, what?
Separating eggs. She doesn't know what it means. But she doesn't even know what it means, let alone how to do it.
I don't know what it means.
What? To separate the yolk and the
separate the yolk and the white.
Okay.
Used for cooking, baking.
Okay, yep. Easy. Bro.
Okay,
I
Darren
believe,
sympathizes. Jesus.
I do. I'm feeling I'm immediately related. And I'm thinking about how I got my last promotion now and going, yeah, this is a very relatable story.
I've also learned how to separate eggs. Yes. The inn is very cute and it's a nice
setting.
Sorry,
it's very exciting.
And the male lead's aunt is played by Andie MacDowell, who is clearly living her best life. She's also meant to have grown up in this small New England town, yet inexplicably has a lovely southern twang going on, so we won't dwell on that. But also, the politics in this one were fascinating, because the spoiled heiress walking down the street with the guy doesn't want to give money to like the homeless guy in the street. And she's like, my fiancé says not to do that. It's like harmful to them or something. And the guy's just like, hell is wrong with you? So then at the end, her evil fiance is dispatched. So she's learned charity is a good thing, you see? And she even bakes cookies for people. It's
cookies is a big
important.
Thing here. I'm seeing as a theme running through it.
You've never watched a Christmas movie, have you?
Yeah, well, okay, not like not deliberately.
Like a Netflix,
Christmas-y.
Like a,
no,
like,
no,
a like a Hallmark
I've watched,
Christmas
like,
movie.
You know, Christmas movies growing up and
yeah,
stuff.
Cookies kind of, they scale out when you hit cinema level, but they're very big below cinema level.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You know, they're just baked into the concept.
Stop. I will watch a couple of this year because I'm curious.
You can probably miss this one. It's not the best.
No, the first one seems to be
fine.
The best so far.
A Christmas Prince is worth watching. And this other one is worth watching, Once Upon a Holiday, which I have now seen at least once for the past 3 years.
Great.
I first discovered this on the Christmas Movie Channel 2 years ago when I was a student and I could watch TV during the afternoon and it was great.
Good times.
Anyway, it's kind of, the plot is a bit like Roman Holiday in that she's a princess again from an unnamed European country. This one, however, has an American accent and everyone around her has an American accent. So I don't know how they don't twig like that she's not American, because she sounds American. It's plot hole.
You're probably overthinking.
Don't dwell on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so she doesn't feel like doing her Christmas duties. And she used to visit New York when she was a child with her mother, and they'd go to like a photographic exhibition. She wants to do that again. So basically, she just runs off from her royal duties for the day and wants to have a little ramble around New York. But of course, she gets mugged, and a guy sees her get mugged and is all like, oh my God, like, are you okay? And is trying to help her.
My name is Prince Charming.
He might be the love interest.
What?
And he has a tragic story of his own. See, what? He used to be...
Did he have a horrible experience where he can't enjoy Christmas anymore?
No, okay. Not that bad. Oh my God, there was a great one of those in Christmas Inheritance, though, where like he got dumped, and immediately after he got dumped, Silent Night started playing, so he hates
Silent Night.
He associates
it with...
And I love Trump on jukebox like this.
At one stage, he gets up and goes over and is like, I hate this song, and is literally like walloping it. It's silly. Anyway, no, in Once Upon a Holiday...
This'll be a Silent Night smash. Sorry.
That got very dark. But no, in Once Upon a Holiday, the guy used to be a stockbroker, but he just didn't like it. Making all that money just wasn't for him. He wanted to make things with his hands. He wanted to be a carpenter. But his fiancée did not want to live the impoverished carpenter's life, so she left him. And he's been nursing a broken heart ever since.
This carpenter is also very Christmassy as well.
Yes, right? So anyway, they start hanging out and sort of bumping into each other because, again, she's lost New York and seems very unperturbed by this fact while her royal handlers are looking for her. And there's also a bizarre subplot where his sister's boyfriend, who's a terrible reporter, is looking for this lost princess but doesn't have Google because he doesn't know what she looks like. So he keeps bumping into her and being like, I'm working on this like big story and so on, and doesn't realize
he
the big story
like
is standing in front of
him. Terrible journalist.
He's an idiot.
Yeah.
As opposed to all other cinematic journalists who are just paradigms of the form.
But anyway, the story in this one is, I don't know, it's there's something very sweet and cute about it, and I like the way it has a little bit of the Roman holiday going on and the thing with the carpenter, and they all just seem like very nice, genuine people, and I can get on board with that.
What I like about your description
of
it is, right, is that
how similar they all are.
No, that's fine, but how you view them though, it's quite discerning even within the
within the genre. Like, there's kind of layering.
It's not they're all crap, but they're all enjoyable. Like, there is standouts
of,
like good standouts and bad standouts, which are like anything, but a lot of people don't go
to
the trouble.
That's what I'm trying to delve into, you know. There's always some nice politics and some this lovely kind of wishful aspect that, like, can't we all just be the good people that we're meant to be at this brilliant time of year when everyone's all about goodwill and giving and honesty instead of being the miserable wretches we probably
blame
are.
Capitalism. Blame capitalism. That's what I say.
We know who to blame.
People need Christmas to remind them of how good they can be.
Yeah.
That sounds like something from a Nolan film.
That's a line that's from a Christmas movie that's coming out next week.
Oh, grim.
Oh, great.
I think I know what he means.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my haul for the week. If I had to pick just two of them, I would say watch A Christmas Prince and watch Once Upon a Holiday.
Noted.
Cool. I'm going to rush very, very quickly through mine. We're going to do a lightning round because I've actually watched a whole bunch because it's screener season. So let's take a look and sort of run through them very quickly. The best of the bunch was Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary looking at Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
The one that died in its arse in the UK cinema.
Nobody knows who he is on this side.
It's not across the Atlantic, I think.
It earned, I think, about as much as that Uma Thurman movie about babysitting, if I remember correctly. $88 on its opening weekend. A total of $8 per screen or something crazy like that. Which is a shame because it's actually really
I heard good things.
It's Morgan Neville. It's the guy who did 20 Feet from Stardom, who also did the Orson Welles one recently. I know you're not a big fan of those documentaries. They're very well told, though, and they get into what they're doing in a way that's accessible. And I really, really like this. And I may have even almost teared up at one point when they played
Darren.
The Mistake song.
Darren, the monster Mooney has teared up.
I'm very easily affected by this sort of thing. I'm very easily manipulated. Other films I watched include Disobedience, which is the long-delayed film that was supposed to play at the Film Festival this year.
Oh, I really want to see
which
this.
Is opening, I think, at the end of November here. It is perfectly adequate. It is exactly the statistical mean that you would expect from a premise about a bunch two lesbians inside the Orthodox Jewish community. It's that modern sort of style of like prestige cinema where nobody actually talks about anything. They all talk around things. You have a bunch of great actors, you got a bunch of big ideas, and you sort of dance around the point that you're trying to make, and you occasionally have little shouty scenes between them so that you can put them in awards clips, but it doesn't really work. There are moments when it comes very close to working. There's a wonderful moment where they're sitting at a table having a conversation with this woman played by Rachel Weisz-Ronnet, who's been exiled from the community by her father because of her sexuality and her orientation, stuff like that. And they're talking about how she credits under a westernized name. And obviously this is something that's very uncomfortable to the elder members of the community for obvious reasons in terms of assimilation, in terms of the erasure of Jewish identity. At which point Esty, who is the character played by Rachel McAdams, points out that women have their identities erased all the time. They marry They marry a man. They take his name, and all of a sudden their history is just erased. And that's a beautiful moment. It's a moment where the film seems to get what it's trying to say about the idea of oppression as a self-perpetuating system, where you can have communities that have historically been oppressed perpetuating oppression. But the film seems afraid to commit to that idea. And I can understand why, given the history of the Jewish community and particular things as they are at the moment. But it feels like the film dances around what should be sort of interesting subject matter. It never kind of bites in or chews on any of the sort of interesting
I've almost seen this at Dublin. I've almost saw it at Galway.
Yeah,
instead, I ended up watching the World Cup final in the book.
It just keeps getting moved. Otherwise, Colette, which I enjoyed quite a bit. It's a much more conventional biography. It's the, again, you're talking about people living in a vaguely defined European country speaking British accents. In this case, it's Paris, where Keira Knightley and Dominic West play... play this sort of Parisian couple. It's the life
of... A Parisian couple.
It's remarkable. They don't even try to affect accents. They're literally...
That seems profoundly insulting to the French.
It's amazing. I didn't realise until the Eiffel Tower was there that they were in France. But it gets even better because while none of the cast, all the surrounding cast are British and not affecting accents, they bring in a British actor who's playing an American from New Orleans. And I must say, Mr. Coyle, she does affect the most ridiculous of accents.
Right. Why?
It's astounding because none of the other actors are affecting accents.
Why would you do it then?
But it's kind of, it's a very straightforward story. It's a story of an author trying to assert control of her work and her husband trying to wrest that from her and her trying to define her own identity as well.
A story as old as time.
And it's very conventional. It hits all the beats. But it hits all those beats in a way that leaves enough room for it to be playful in other ways. There's a lot of clever mirroring going on. There's a lot of clever sort of like self-awareness, sort of metatextual stuff in terms of there's a point where she fictionalizes her own childhood in order to sell books. And her husband then writes his own name on the cover of them, stealing her fictionalized childhood, and then gets her to dress up as a character that is a fictionalized version of her so that he can basically parade her around as his creation. It's one. It's this whole of mirrors thing, which is absolutely fascinating.
Wasn't that like the subplot in Gone Girl with her parents?
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's not also the
amazing Amy subplot.
Isn't that also the Tim Burton film from a couple of years
Big
ago?
Oh
yeah, Big Eyes. Big Eyes.
Yeah, it's much better than Big Eyes. It's not fantastic, but it's quite like it's solid mid-tier awards fair stuff. Speaking of solid mid-tier awards fair stuff, rewatch Battle of the Sexes, which was one of the ones that got lost last year, which I quite enjoyed.
I quite liked it.
Yeah,
I really, it's very straightforward.
I had this on my laptop for 18 months and still haven't looked at it.
It's enjoyable, well made, well acted. Doesn't do anything crazy or weird.
Clean, I agree.
It
hits all its marks along the way, but it does so in a way that reminds you of why that template works as well as it does. Like, this is sort of old school Oscar fair stuff. I was talking about Disobedience as like the archetypal modern prestige cinema stuff where it's like you don't talk about things out loud.
Yeah.
You have meaningful glances and conversations around things.
That's the adult version of the Sundance film, in my opinion.
This sort of thing. Whereas, Battle of the Sexes is admittedly very formulaic and very heavy-handed, but it's done with enough skill and enough charm that you kind of go along with it.
I'd go with that. I thought it was very solid.
The cast are fantastic as well. I will say one of the things, since I watched it last year, one of the things that hasn't aged well is its portrayal of Bobby Riggs, which is fascinating because you can tell the film was written at a point when Trump was going for election and everybody thought that he was just pretending to be racist and misogynist and bigoted in order to appeal to the masses and sort of generate publicity for his ventures. In that Bobby Riggs is presented as this sort of like playful chauvinist who's just exploiting this wave of like deep-seated sort of hatred of women in order to further his own financial adventures and to get himself out of debt. It watches less well like a couple of years removed from that, where you're like, no, he actually is a white supremacist to his orange tinged bones.
Yeah.
So that aspect of the film hasn't aged particularly well. Otherwise, the big one was They Shall Not Grow Old. Which I'm not sure if we have time to talk about because this is going to be a big discussion. So we may come back to that, put a pin in that and come back to it next week.
Put a pin is probably not the greatest phrase.
For this one,
I would suggest.
Why not?
It's a grenade.
Okay. Whoa. You went somewhere very dark.
Oh, I didn't. That's the phrase. That's where the phrase comes from.
Really? I didn't know. Okay.
I thought
that's
where it came from.
Okay, cool. I thought it was just to hold it in place. I thought it was like a pin and a. Okay.
No, defusing a situation. I see what you mean.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And Shoplifters, which I thought was okay.
This is the Palme d'Or winning Carita film. In fairness to Palme d'Or films.
It can't be that unusual for Palme d'Or films to be just
okay. But the Palme won Palme d'Or a couple of years ago, which is not very good. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not it. any measure of quality.
This is the Fast and the Furious directed by Mike Lee, which is probably a really weird description of it, but it captures it quite perfectly. It's this idea of a found family and a found family brought together by criminal activity. It's like there are moments that are genuinely touching in it. There's some wonderful compositions, as you might imagine it being a Corrida film. Yeah. There's an absolutely beautiful shot where a kid carrying a bunch of oranges jumps off a rail and the shot just has the oranges roll into shot, you know, underneath to illustrate that the kid is like not in a good place. There's lots of beautiful shots like that, some wonderful use of rain, but it's all very paint by numbers. For years we've been getting sort of stories along these lines, and it doesn't feel like it says anything.
But Corrida pretty much has been knocking them out year after year. One day I will love him as much as
everybody
else seems to think he's a god.
I've seen three or four of them.
I'm like, really? And people keep saying, no, you haven't seen this one, this is amazing. And then I watch the thing that
I hate when
amazing.
People do that. Not about this person in particular, but
in general,
when you're just like, oh, you need to see this, you need to see that. It's like, if you don't connect with it, it's fine.
But Grace,
everything is for everyone.
I would agree, but you'll probably listen to that from me when you don't like Scorsese films. Like, yeah, but you haven't seen this one, Grace. I tell you, this is amazing.
Oh, don't worry.
So I'll reserve the right to hold that in place.
Okay.
And finally, for Mooney Family Movie Night on Saturday, we watched Crazy Rich Asians again, which is the second time I've seen it, and it's adorable.
I'm watching it soon. I have to watch, so I'm going to watch it.
It's, again, very conventional, very straightforward, doesn't have any real surprises in it, but hits all its marks along the way. And watching it a second time, I was particularly well impressed with the little nuances that you get. You know, between, to quote a movie that we're going to be talking about in the top 10, the notes that it can hit between those two octaves, so to speak, in that it understands the rhythms and structures of romantic comedy enough that it can do little things within it.
Okay.
And it can have a little bit of nuance in there that I really appreciated. The cast is fantastic, the sense of humor is warm, and it does everything that you wanted to do without it ever seeming like it's an obligation, which is really, really good.
All right, fair enough.
All right, then. Let's move on to talking about the week in film news very, very quickly. So Stan Lee passed away on Monday, which was, quite a blow. He was 95 years old.
It's a pretty good innings.
He was starting to seem like he was immortal.
No, that's it. He was one of those, and again, this is because I was a kid who grew up reading comics and that sort of stuff and would have known Stan Lee since forever. I never really figured that he was mortal. You know, the way that you have that association with people that you've known since childhood, where you were like, that person is there. They are just an object. They are a permanent object. Lee is astounding. He was a huge part of my childhood and a lot of people's childhood. And obviously, when you talk about Lee, you have to bring up the issue of authorship, which is very contested between himself and, say, Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of discussions that need to take place about that, about the crediting of work that everybody did to build the universe that many people just credit to Stan Lee.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time, though, like, I can't imagine... Like, and again, this is something that's very crass. It's like, I can't imagine a massive multimedia empire existing without Stan Lee, but I can't imagine comic books as they exist today, for better or worse, existing without Stan Lee.
It's a 20th century culture colossus.
That is exactly. Like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or the idea of like shared universes obviously existed before in literature. You think of like Moorcock and stuff like that, but obviously even like the Universal Monster movies in the 30s.
Yeah.
But like on a scale of like the Marvel Cinematic Universe creating this idea of how to create a multimedia franchise, that largely is down to Lee deciding that that Spider-Man should audition for the Fantastic Four in the first issue of his comic.
Yeah.
And you can trace all through that. And again, you have his style, his prose, you know, while everybody, you know, it's very easy to criticize his prose. Reading it as a child, his prose style was perfectly like hyperbolic, playful, welcoming. It was very much, it was in an oral tradition.
Yeah.
It was like you were being told a story by somebody who was really excited about it and wanted to share it with you. And that is kind of what I think about when I think about Stan Lee. And even like his cameos at the age of 90, where he's popping up, you know, on buses or like giving life advice or delivering phones or making witty one-liners to Mr. Stank. Like there was an impishness.
And there's more
to
come, if I read correctly.
I believe so.
I wasn't a big comic book reader when I was young. Most of the comic books, I was aware of Stan Lee, obviously, but I would have watched a lot of comic cartoons and stuff when I was growing up more. So that's where I would have got my kind of comic knowledge from. But I'm aware of the kind of shadowy cast hugely.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, so and famously, he inspired several characters, including J. Jonah Jameson was apparently based on Lee.
I can see that.
Yes, just a little bit with the hyperbole and stuff like that. And he also the mailman Willie Lumpkin.
As a slight aside, somebody I saw wrote on Twitter, which I quite liked, a film I loved when I was younger, but I haven't seen probably in 20 years, that was apparently credited as one of his first cameos, which was The Ambulance with Eric Roberts, which is a great B-movie kind of. Horror thriller. It's really good. Apparently he's in that. Now I don't recall that.
Okay.
But now I want to rewatch just to see. But it's really good if anybody wants to watch it. It's fun.
Perfect.
Proper B movie.
Perfect. In terms of film news, the big news this week is the Irish Film in London. Yes. They announced their awards this week. And they're having a festival at the weekend. And basically heading into the weekend, they announced their awards for various Irish films. The best Irish film, which was sponsored by Scannon, by the way. We're going international here. Was announced as Rosie.
I can't really argue with that. Documentary aside, it would be certainly the best fiction film I've seen this year from Ireland.
It certainly seems like the most culturally relevant.
Yeah, but even aside from that, I would argue that it's a breakout film in its own terms. Mm-hmm. Like, issues can certainly override that a little bit. And, you know, important doesn't necessarily mean good, mm-hmm. you know, but it is good despite being important, which I think a distinction is important.
And worth noting, by the way, and I would agree that it is both good and important. Yeah. I think it hits both those markers very well. Also worth noting that The Lonely Battle of Thomas Reed actually won Best Documentary when you're talking about, like, non-documentary.
Yeah, I really like Lonely Battle of Thomas Reed. My favourite documentary, though, was The Image of Mist, which hasn't disappeared, but similar to his previous film, Donald Foreman's previous film, they don't quite maybe got out into the world as big as I'd hoped, but he's a phenomenal filmmaker, and The Image of Mist is absolutely glorious.
The best short film went to Nyssa Rafter's Early Days.
Would be our short film.
Ronan is our guru here on this one. It's quite impressive. The festival is actually running this weekend as well. We should mention, by the way, The Lonely Battle of Thomas Reed is still in Irish cinemas.
Yes, and well worth seeing.
Did it just get a wider release, or did it always have?
It's kind of extending a lead a little bit.
Opening out west.
It is exactly. It's opening in Castlebar, Donegal, and Belfast in the coming weeks, and it's also in London's Dockhouse at the Curzon Bloomsbury. And there'll be, if you are listening to this on the 24th of November, so in a week or so, there'll be a special Q&A screening as well.
Yeah.
So that may be very much worth seeing. I really like that for fans of cinema, of good cinema in general, but of Irish cinema in particular.
Documentary, which we are very good at.
We are very, very good at. In terms of other film news, the industry leaders are gathering in Cork for the Cork Film Festival's Industry Days. That's still.
And why wasn't I in Cork?
I know. Why weren't you put on that shortlist?
Damn it.
I'm very confused by this festival. How long is it running for? Or am I getting
it? It's running over weekends, so it's not running continuously.
That's actually quite a good idea.
It means that you can get down to it if you're outside of Cork, which is a very good idea. I mean, they're having their second annual documentary day, as you're listening to this probably, on Friday, the 16th of November. So they're doing that there as well. So, like, there is a whole host of stuff still happening there.
Some really good stuff lined up.
Yeah. And just very quickly then, we'll also mention the Dublin Feminist Film Festival is running next week. We had Jennifer on last week, so she went through the program in a great deal of depth, but there may still be tickets available if you want to order online. We will be hanging around.
If anybody has any issues to dispute of the last few months, you want to take it up with us, we'll be there to defend ourselves.
Who could possibly issues with us?
Some bros are going to show up and tackle us.
I really hope so. I'm a terrible fighter. Grayson, I'm going to put you in front and centre. You look angry.
Let's...
I'm thin, but I'm wiry.
That's it. We all need those.
She's fast. All right, so let's move on to talking everybody's favorite part of the show, the top 10.
Oh, and
bring it on.
Okay,
bring it on us.
At number 10, and I had to do some sneaky Googling of this one, ladies and gentlemen, it's Squadron 303, also known as Hurricane. It is a Polish production starring Euan Rion about Polish fighters during the Second World War.
Interesting.
It does. I'm surprised.
Reviews are a little sniffy, if I remember correctly, from a couple weeks ago.
The ratings on IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes are quite low, although who credits IMDb ratings?
I think a lot of people said it was solid enough.
I've gotten to the stage where I literally don't trust anyone. I never trusted Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb, but even most critics these days, I'm like, none of you know what you're talking about.
I have never gone on to Rotten Tomatoes, ever.
I don't trust me.
I
don't trust me either. At number 9, it's Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween. Hasn't it got the memo?
I still haven't seen Goosebumps. Should I see Goosebumps?
We haven't seen Goosebumps.
You haven't seen
We saw The House with the Clock in its Wall.
You should see The House with the Clock in its Wall.
Yeah, it's quite good.
That was really fun.
It's very old-fashioned ambulance style. It has a little bit too much CGI, but you can sort of first two-thirds.
Jack Black and Kate Blanchett.
Is it small kid-friendly?
Yes.
I'd say so.
Yeah, I can't see why
I don't think there's anything overtly scary.
The worst thing about it is that there's a lion that poops, except it's made of grass, so it poops leaves.
Okay, that's perfect. No, I'm babysitting next week, so that might be one.
It'd be a good show.
Yeah, good.
That might be one, but this might also be one. At number 8, Overlord.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, depending on the child.
Yeah, she's.
She shows. Well, Overlord,
I think she does have an eye for the kind of. She does like her Studio Ghibli and stuff like that. So, yeah. Not Raven the Firefly is Studio Ghibli.
I think Overlord is probably not quite.
I am not for a second. And if her dad is listening, I am not proposing to show Overlord.
It's just a small leap from Studio Ghibli to like people being impaled in meetups.
It really is. Raven the Firefly is your link.
Yeah. And then after that, show her Mandy.
No, we're going for good films, Grace.
Speaking of good films, and we're going for good films. At number 7, do you want to take a guess what's at number 7? I'll give you a hint. We've talked about it for the past 4 weeks, and you probably can't remember what
First
it is.
Man.
Star is Born.
Neither of you got it.
Wow.
What else do we talk
Johnny
about?
Johnny English strikes again.
Oh, Christ, okay. Yeah.
Every week this comes up, and we're like, how is this still here?
Film.
And once again, I'd like to reiterate, how is this still here?
And is somehow better organized than the British government's attempts at Brexit.
Not be difficult.
That would not
1.4 million at the Irish
who
box office
sees
today.
This?
These are all those English people who are over here with their Irish passports.
I'm going to say that room. And a great dollar,
that's
I presume,
what I'm going
is,
to say.
I would imagine so. And Rowan Atkinson
is
very
popular. This is an 80s kind
yeah.
of...
throwback sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, Mr. Bean territory yeah. kind of stuff.
At number 6, it's Smallfoot, proving that there's maybe only room for so many animated children-friendly films at the moment in
there's
the
There's room for a billion of them.
Oh, don't
People
worry.
Will go to see
this,
all of them.
This might just be a slow season. Like, once they get out of school...
This is not a slow season. Wait until we get to number 1.
Oh, for the kids, I mean.
Oh, no. Wait until we get to number 1.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Grace. I have no idea.
Really?
No.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
I've forgotten.
We don't know anything about
we
kids.
We don't. We're
it's animation. We're not paying attention.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Okay. very mean-spirited of you.
I know.
At number 5.
Mean-spirited of us?
By the way, that was not casting shade, as the kids call it. That was a playful hint. At number 5, it's Nutcracker and the Four Realms.
Yeah.
Yep, definitely.
Okay.
Still a movie.
It's still a film
still
in there.
Still kind of want to see it, but have not made any effort to go.
You really
see
haven't,
it.
Grace.
Haven't made effort to see Venom yet.
I like that. I want to see it, but I don't like want to have to go to the hassle.
Could
of
somebody
going
bring
to see
it to me? Yeah.
The problem is very much the type of cinemas that these things
yes,
play in. When
indeed.
I'm used to going to like high class cinemas, and then if I have to go to like a multiplex with
Please.
The plebs, then I'm just like, no.
At number 4, a new entry and performing very well with €200,000 at the box office to date. It's Widows, Steve McQueen's Widows.
Ooh, now this I actually will see.
Yes, I should see this next week, I would imagine.
I'm really excited about this. I loved it when I saw it, and it was great when other people loved it too, because everyone likes that little bit of validation.
I almost never get it, but I do like it when it happens.
Jay.
So.
I've
been rediscovering all of my... Well, not all of them, but many, many teen movies that I loved when I was a teenager, and seeing everyone in Letterboxd give them 4.5 stars makes me very happy, because some people understand cultural impact and some people don't.
But yes, so Widows is opening in the States this weekend, and I'm very excited. And if you are an American listener to this podcast, go out and see it. It's fantastic.
I'm probably seeing this and Suspiria in a double bill next
nice.
Week.
Nice. I'm hoping
I also
Suspiria.
Want to see Suspiria.
But we're going to talk about that later. All right. So if you haven't seen Widows, chances are you were probably at the cinema seeing A Star Is Born again at number 3.
I have not seen it again, but it's fine.
I still feel like there's a lot of very harsh reviews of this going around. And I don't mean reviews from critics. I mean reviews from people who may or may not
be
on
this
podcast.
But may not be on this podcast right
Me?
Now to defend themselves.
No. Just some very harsh comments. I'm kind of like, I don't think it's as egregious as some people are making out.
We should point out, in defense of the podcast panelist who is not present, Grace...
That wasn't aimed specifically at Ronan.
Grace famously joked that the rating system on this film went from
3.5 to 3 to 2.5
at J. And Ronan came in on one end of that scale, and we'll let you guess which one next week, listeners.
Oh, I haven't really talked to Ronan about this.
My mom would level
intrigued.
This out with a 4-star review.
Well, I would be a 2.5. I know it's okay.
He could have given a 4 either. He's at one extreme of that scale, but listeners will have to tune in next week to find out
I am actually quite excited to know.
At number 2, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, Christ. Okay.
Which is now on the IMDb, the 125th best movie of all time. It's already earned €2 million at the Irish box office. It is on track in the States to be the most successful musical biographical film of all time.
Does this mean we can look forward to lots of sanitized, sanguine biopics that say very little about certain circumstances of their subject's life?
You know what Dexter Fletcher is moving on to next?
Oh, Dexter, what are you doing?
Elton John.
Yes, Rocket Man.
Oh, Dexter.
Was supposed to star Tom Hardy, but he dropped out and was replaced by... Taran Egerton, yeah, the guy from Robin Hood.
Yeah, God.
Dexter, why?
Also, can we point out, this is also validating like Bryan Singer, by the way. Yeah. Everybody that goes to see this.
It's earned €2 million at the Irish box office to date, which is a phenomenal amount of money.
Not from my money.
By the way, it should be noted, A Star Is Born passed Infinity War this week.
People of Queen. This is exactly
I'm
it.
I'm quite impressed by that Star Is Born passing Infinity War, though.
Huh. Yeah, it's gone supernova.
Infinity War is a better film.
At number one, what do we think is there, guys?
We don't know.
Absolutely no idea.
We don't know.
Really?
We should research more. Actually, okay. I have a piece of paper, in fairness.
Okay.
What have you got, Grace?
My phone's on my lap.
Ah, good enough.
It's The Grinch.
Oh, right, yeah.
Opening at number one, proving it's never too early to get start complaining about
Christmas.
Oh,
yes, yes. Sorry, we remember
this
from last
week. I can't talk. I've been watching Slush all week.
That's
self-inflicted.
The Grinch has done a phenomenal job. It did a number on The Girl with the Girl in the Spider's Web over in the States this weekend.
Isn't that because that's terrible?
Yes, but we're going to talk about that in a moment.
Sorry.
But yeah, The Grinch is astonishing. I've been looking at the publicity campaign that they've been running for it. It's astounding. Like, this is the publicity campaign for The Grinch features the animated character voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch randomly ringing up NBA All-Stars to complain about their performance in the locals, in sort of like the most recent sporting tournaments they've been playing.
So they've made him a troll.
They've made him a troll. The Twitter account for The Grinch is complaining about Friday Night Football. This thing has gone massive.
I'm getting old. This is exhausting.
Yeah, it's a four-dimensional cinematic experience.
No, it isn't.
Interestingly enough, the reviews of it are grand. Yeah. Nobody particularly loves it, but very few
like
people hate it.
It looks like a fairly solid three star.
Yeah, that's it. Like,
probably watched it if it was on telly, that kind of thing.
Is it Bill Jabiri? Made a very good case for it, arguing that there's something about watching a movie where a bad person actually learns a lesson that feels almost cathartic in this sort of environment at the moment.
Yeah, I can see that. If it does, in fact, commit
if
to
If only
that.
We could teach the right bad people the right Indeed. Lessons, you know what I'm saying?
But anyway, let's move on to the new releases out this week. So, couple of new releases on Netflix. The big one is the Coen Brothers film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yeah, that's out next Friday. Tomorrow.
That's out tomorrow. It played in Curzon Cinemas this Friday, weekend.
Will I see this tomorrow? No, we won't see this tomorrow.
Okay. But no, I mean, you could, but the great thing about it being on Netflix is you can watch it anytime you want.
That's true. I cannot wait to watch it.
It's very accessible. I quite liked it. I didn't love it, but I want to watch it again, which is interesting. So this has an all-star cast, in inverted commas, but it's got everybody from Joey Kazan, James Franco, Tim Blake Nelson, Liam Neeson, Brendan Gleeson. Tom Waits is in there as well. It's got this sort of, and the structure of it is that it's six short stories. It's an anthology
six
film.
Episodes, and he just edited this, it last
this is
minute,
reported,
isn't it, right?
They've denied this. And
of course they have, but it's nonsense.
Okay, but I don't know. The argument is that it was falsely announced by Netflix or falsely interpreted from the press release.
Well, hang on a second. It was announced months ago, and then all of a sudden, a few months later, it was announced as a movie.
I think that the press release described it as an anthology, and they just assumed it was a series.
But it's kind of a weird project where I feel like I've heard the title a gazillion times and have absolutely no idea about any of it.
Six stories in the West, essentially.
It's six stories in the West, but what's interesting about it is that it's very much in the style of, and again, the argument is that I read this on the AV Club a couple of years ago, and it's a very good argument how the Coens have produced films, is that they tend to produce films in duology. So they'll release one film and it will happen to reflect quite well in the next film they're doing. So, you know, you think of like Pairs, for example, like famously of No Country for Old Men and Burn After Reading, where they serve almost as mirror images one another because the brothers famously wrote them back to back almost.
And Barton Fink and Miller's Cross and that kind of thing. It's about writer's block and the one was written out the other as well. Like, things like that.
And that sort of stuff. And here you can almost see that with Hail Caesar, in that Hail Caesar is a story about like this American myth-making institution. It's very episodic. It's full of these random things that indulge the Coen brothers' love of cinema. And about a Buster Scruggs is very much exactly the same thing. It's not a story about the West. It's a story about the stories that we tell about the West. Its six films are basically structured in a way to mirror the progression of myths that America's told about its old
West. I don't mind that idea. That's it. It's not a bad idea, particularly
with America and it's self-serving.
This is more revisionist, I presume.
It's not a straight
up. I find the Coen brothers very hit and miss.
Well, I can get that. I can think there are films that I really, really like, and there are films that I dismiss.
Yeah.
And there's some in the middle in that kind of
the great thing about the Coen brothers is that you get five people together and they will have a completely different list of those. Like, I do not like A Serious Man, and I know that you love A Serious Man.
Yes, and I don't like
you don't like True Grit, and I love True Grit.
Loves.
Yeah, I like True Grit.
I thought it was terrible.
And you can get this entirely.
I didn't like No Country for Old Men, though. I'm like, me and my brother are like the only two people on the
I haven't rewatched No Country for Old Men since I saw it in the cinema, and I'm curious to go back to it.
I remember
some
finding
point.
It very boring.
I wonder if you think it differently of if you watch it again. When did you see it?
We're doing that Corita thing, aren't we, Jay? But you need to watch this film. Except no, we're doing, but you need to watch this film Cumber again.
Films can be very interesting on rewatch, though, a few years later. That's what I mean. Okay, okay. They lend themselves to rewatch as an like interesting Lewin kind Davis, of thing. Though. Which?
I like Lewin Davis.
Yeah, me too.
But
there's a cat in that. Could that be part of it?
Yes.
There is a dog in one of these stories here.
How big or he's small, and is there violence against the dog?
No comment. He's
there we
called,
are.
He's called, what's he called? President Porter or Portis? President Poulter. But anyway, so it's six stories, each of which is structured along a line of like American thought. So you have, for example, the opening sequence is like the 50s singing cowboy, like the kind that Eldrin Ildrick would be playing in Hail Caesar. So
Last Day on the Moon or whatever.
Yes. Nothing but respect for my
big old moon.
Yeah, except he's played by Tim Blake Nelson as a wonderful sociopath. It's fantastic. It's hilarious. It's a one-note joke, but it's just long enough in a short film that it works.
Yeah.
Second segment does this Sergio Leone thing where you've got a lot of ambient sound, a lot of silence, the Bank of Tucumcari, and this sort of nihilism and lots of lynching going on with James Franco. Third section is kind of Liam Neeson. He's on tour. Fourth section is Tom Waits doing Little House on the Prairie, which is 70s style reconstructive westerns.
That. I want that. All of that.
You have like, and then the fifth section, it brings it more recently with doing sort of like a Kelly rollback sort of like Meek's Cutoff, but with Zoe Kazan involved. And then you've got to go to the more recent and more modern one where the closing section is very clearly a Tarantino revisionist western with lots of people talking very smartly about things in a trapped environment together where they are not who they appear to be. So you have this entire charting of the western genre in a film.
That's an interesting way of doing it. I'd say.
Now, obviously, it'll work different for different people, and certain segments didn't work as well for me.
But that's always going to be way in that kind of.
Like we just talked, we just talked about how the great thing about the Coen brothers is that people have different opinions of each film. So I imagine that people will have different opinions of each one. Because I've heard people rave about ones that I did like, and I liked ones that other people really hated. Which
I'm curious to watch it. I'll have watched it by the time next week's podcast rolls around. Certainly.
And then also out on Netflix is Cam, just to give it a quick shout out, which is the Blumhouse horror movie about a cam girl who finds that a cam girl is a woman who performs on camera for the amusement of an audience, usually in sexual terms.
Isn't there a different
name for
that?
It's from the studio that can't find any female horror directors, folks.
Okay.
It was written by a woman.
Oh my God, they acknowledge they exist.
Okay.
Tell it, Grace.
Yeah. But so I...
That's how I currently feel about Blumhouse.
Okay. I would argue that Blumhouse are one of the great studios in terms of social commentary at the moment, doing stuff like Get Out, for example, and things like that. And I would recommend Cam. Cam is a very clever sort of
Hitchcockian. I feel like Tyra Banks here being like, I rooted for you. How dare you?
But yeah, Cam is available online and is very worth seeking out.
And is it good?
It's good. It's better when it doesn't explain its monster. It's probably my favorite of the new releases. It has issues in that, like, it has this sort of like vertigo thing where it's about like this persona that you create on the internet and when this persona takes on life beyond yourself. And so you have this idea of this woman. That's it, exactly. This woman who projects this image of herself online in order to like build up a persona as a cam girl and to make money and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Who discovers one day that her account is locked, but it's somehow operating and she's on it and she's in the room where she's watching herself.
Ah, you see, you're talking about then the bit in most really not confident.
From inside the house.
Yeah, the confident horrors that kind of stop around the 3/4 mark to tell you exactly why such
there
is happening.
There is a slight
here's what's going on.
Let's just steal all the tension away here.
And to be fair, it doesn't tell you everything that's going on, but it does have to stop and offer something that approximates a rational explanation, imposes rules
on
the monster.
Why do they do these things? I never understand it.
I don't know either, but it's not a huge flaw, but it is a flaw.
Okay.
The film itself is generally quite good.
Okay,
it's arguably most horrific before anything supernatural happens. There's a good half hour where it's just exploring the life of a woman who works in this industry.
As much of a horror show as it is.
No,
it's
incredibly skin crawling.
Being a woman in life is skin crawling in many ways.
So I have heard. I would not know.
All right, so let's take a look at what's out this week in cinemas. The big one this week is The Crimes of Grindelwald.
For who? Oh, yeah, for people that love Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Graham likes it.
Before I talk about this very briefly, I want to tell a little story because it shows I'm not entirely heartless. I remember when I came out in the cinema, there were little kids.
I love that you think there are people who think you're heartless when you're sitting next to the two of us.
Yeah.
But so I came out of the,
just saying.
Came out in the cinema after watching the film, walking to the car park, eavesdropping on the families who've been watching it, and these little six-year-old kids saying and trying to explain the plot of the movie they just watched their parents. The parents had no idea what was going on, had no idea what any of the revelations in the film meant, but the kids were like, no, Ma, you don't get it. It's really that spoiler. It's spoiler, spoiler. Didn't you get that's why he could spoiler the spoiler? And there's so much enthusiasm there and kids like intrinsically understand it. And it's kind of magical in its own way. And I want to say that before I say the film is not good at all.
Oh,
And I mean,
darn,
like,
knife to the heart. Darren is a monster.
It means like, it's great that it means it, this is a film that's very much for the kind of people who enjoy reading the appendices to Lord of the Rings.
Oh,
it's full of
people,
scenes
yeah.
that are full of exposition.
You mean me?
Okay, well,
those people.
Well, okay, if you
but
also like Harry Potter.
To Harry
yeah,
Potter,
if you also
like
Harry
Potter.
Harry Potter.
Are
you
but I am one of those people who reads the appendices of Lord of the Rings.
Are you
repeatedly.
Excited about the Silmarillion? Silmarillion?
Silmarillion?
Yeah.
What about it?
Are you excited about it? The prospect of it being filmed?
Only if it's a page-by-page adaptation that's ridiculously over the top and indulgent, yes.
Okay.
I
and
am not
ideally
excited
with
it.
All the Elvish scenes filmed entirely in Elvish with subtitles. And
see,
all
this
that
just... The, what?
If you like Harry Potter like Grace likes Lord of the Rings,
I do not.
This may be the film for you.
It won't be.
It's very much, it's weird. Like, it's, and you can tell watching the film that they've figured out that, like, the worst thing about the thing that they're least interested about the film is the thing that works so, I quite like the last film, is the thing that works so well in the last film, which is the actual Fantastic Beasts. If you look at the logo of the film, you literally have to, like, scrunch your eyes to see the words Fantastic Beasts written on it. When you watch the film, it's very clear that they have a story they want to tell, and they're like, oh, we should probably involve some Fantastic Beasts at some point.
Why is this, though? What's,
it's very
what's the
strange.
Point?
Because Rowling wants to do this big epic prequel to the world of Harry Potter, but she's decided to like sneak it in the back door through Fantastic Beasts. But now they're stuck with the premise of Fantastic Beasts.
So now they're moving away from it.
They're moving away from it, but feel obligated to honour it. Which
for this
is
film
very
only,
strange.
Probably.
I wouldn't be surprised to see little things like that in the next film. But
only as Easter eggs, more
yeah,
like
only
more
that's
than,
it, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, there's a moment where like they reveal that the bad guy secretly has a Fantastic Beast on him, and that's why he fainted at this important moment and stuff like that. It's
so
very,
this is kind of hamstrung by it's
lore and
mythology things, yeah.
And it's desire to tell a story that, to be quite frank, is very similar to the original Harry Potter movies, where
but I thought I was ever
were
in really
ever in?
But no, it was not.
Okay, opening otherwise, The Price of Everything, directed by Nathaniel Kahn, which is with unprecedented access to pivotal artists and the white-hot market surrounding them, this film dives deep into the contemporary art world, holding a funhouse mirror up to their values. I have heard nothing about this.
No.
Nor have I.
This may be of interest to Grace, though. Siberia is opening this week, starring Keanu Reeves as an American diamond trader whose Russian partner goes missing. So Keanu Reeves has to venture to Russia and Siberia in search of him, and instead begins a love affair.
Is what? Keanu making the type of film that, like, Stallone would have made back in the day?
It seems quite like... To be honest, this seems to pitch him as a romantic lead.
This is all the hallmarks of an action film on that last sentence.
And then it curves. It sort of takes a, like, sharp turn. It's like, what if John Wick became You've Got Mail?
But John Wick has this really sad, broken-hearted story at the very beginning of it. Like, we've already established that Keanu is a pure soul who is wounded.
Yeah. Listen, I love Keanu, right? But can we not all just accept that neither of the John Wick movies are very good?
No, we can't.
No, we
Jay,
can't, Jay.
Because
we can't.
You are factually incorrect.
Okay.
And finally, the other big release of the week, Suspiria, which has taken its time getting here. A horror movie that is opening in the middle of November.
Yeah, probably.
Every
could
time
have done
I
a
hear that
earlier.
Title, I want to start singing Disturbia. Suspiria.
I have, this is probably very revealing, I have a similar reaction, but it's not that song. Instead, it's Phil Collins' Suspiria.
Very
anyway,
dancing there.
Sorry, okay. Listeners,
you really didn't want to see that, listeners.
You
you're
can imagine
that.
It in your head.
I might see this week, hopefully soon.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm hoping
I'm
to see it tomorrow night
to it.
As well. Phil saw it at the London Film Festival and was intrigued by it. He didn't love it, he didn't hate it, but he found it fascinating. And
by
I
all
find...
accounts, there seems to be a point where it goes a bit batshit, and I think people seem to be on board until the batshittery starts.
So if you can commit to the batshittery, you may be safe.
I love Suspiria, the original. I think it's absolutely magnificent. I will see this, but I will have my expectations be a little lower than perhaps...
Is there a chance that by next week all three of us will have seen this movie?
There is a chance.
Possibly.
Oh, Faye, fantastic. So listeners will probably have a bit of an in-depth discussion of that next week. But in the meantime, people looking for a bit more Jay, a bit more Grace in their lives, where can they find you guys?
At Jay Coyle on Twitter.
You can follow my Christmas slush on Letterboxd at Pixie Grace.
Unmissable.
And that'll be coming out in an article in next month's In Erin as well, just in time for Christmas, I believe.
Once I write it. Any day now.
No pressure.
No pressure. You can follow me online, Darren Rose Cormier, co-host another podcast called The 250, where this week we are discussing the 126th best movie of all time, Bohemian Rhapsody. We'll be joined by a special guest,
Luke, maniacal laugh.
Luke Dunn of this parish, and
I hope he has a theory for this.
Of not of this parish, but we'll be talking about it in a bit of depth. That'll be coming out late on Saturday, early on Sunday. So keep your ears peeled, listeners.
I shall.
We will rock you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.